Those of you that are longtime listeners of the podcast may be surprised to hear me speaking right now, as it was typically Mohammed Tahir, the longtime media manager for RFERL in Washington, D.C., who hosted the podcast. Mohammed, a wonderful colleague and good friend, has moved on from RFERL. Both the Wilson Center and RFERL are deeply grateful to him for helping make this podcast so successful. We wish him much luck in his future endeavors. The podcast has been on a summer hiatus, though we expect to be back with our regular bi-weekly schedule of podcasts in the early fall of 2022. However, we are posting two new special editions of the podcast, moderated by me, to mark the one-year anniversaries of the Taliban takeover and the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. This week's podcast is the first of the two special editions focused on the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover. Hello and welcome to the AFPAC File, the joint podcast of the Wilson Center and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center and the moderator of today's edition. 1 year ago this week, the Taliban entered Kabul. They did so without having to fire a single bullet. The government collapsed. The president fled the country. The Taliban were in full control. The takeover came as a surprise to many, including U.S. intelligence officials and also President Biden, who had said in a speech just a few weeks earlier that it was unlikely that the Taliban would seize power across the whole country. The takeover led to two chaotic and tragic weeks, with many Afghans rushing to the airport in Kabul, desperate to flee the Taliban. Many of those that wanted to leave were not able to. Many of them are still in Afghanistan today. The Taliban over the last year have brought back many of the draconian policies they implemented when they were last in power in the late 1990s, new restrictions on women's dress and movement, curtailment of girls' education, crackdowns on journalists, among other things. The return of the Taliban to power precipitated a terrible humanitarian and economic crisis because the international sanctions regime on Taliban leaders meant that once they were in power, international financial assistance, on which Afghanistan has long been heavily dependent, slowed to a trickle. The Taliban faced many challenges over the last year. They struggled to adjust from insurgency to governance. They were burdened with huge policy challenges. They faced a persistent terrorist threat from Islamic State Khorasan, and they had to deal with internal divisions that appeared to have grown as the year went on. But 1 year later, the Taliban are still in full control, and they face no viable opposition. The war that ended when the Taliban took power has not resumed. Violence is still very much present, mainly because of Taliban crackdowns and Islamic State terrorism, but it's much lower than previously. Some observers point to Taliban policy achievements over the last year, such as ensuring continued government revenue through border trade and less corruption. So how have Afghans responded to the first year of Taliban rule? What are the impacts, especially on education and women? What might have driven the Taliban's actions? What has the Taliban takeover meant for the broader region? We'll address these questions and hopefully some more on this special edition of the AFPAC File. So we've got a terrific panel to dig into these questions. We have Lindsay Billing, an investigative journalist and photographer who has spent a lot of time in Afghanistan over the last year. Pashtana Durrani, an Afghan women's and education activist and director of LEARN, an NGO dedicated to education and health. Dr. Ashley Jackson, co-director of the Center for the Study of Armed Groups at the Overseas Development Institute. And Andre Ilves, director for the Near East region with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. So thank you all for joining us. And Lindsay, let's start with you. I know that you've been in Afghanistan talking to a lot of people, including outside the major cities in recent months. So what are some of the more striking things that you've heard in your conversations about this last year of Taliban rule?
Thanks, Michael. I mean, I think the main challenges that people are facing right now really do all stem from the economic situation. They're facing food insecurity and an increase in food and fuel prices, and they're facing climate change and a long drought period, which is now, like, to add to this, another bad harvest is in the works. And unemployment and the financial situation are people's biggest concerns right now. They need jobs, and they need secure jobs, and they need food. But the wave of the humanitarian need is really felt across every province, because the health system is continued to be strained by this ongoing economic instability. And before the Taliban took control of the country last August, Afghanistan was already facing a nutritional crisis. Today, hospitals, even in largest cities, are really struggling with this kind of lack of equipment and medicines and other resources. And they're now flooded with children suffering from malnutrition. But, you know, these issues are particularly pronounced in the provinces, which is where I've spent most of my time this year. This is where the majority of the population are living below the poverty line, and infection and malnutrition have long been widespread. These areas are really like reliant on community clinics, which are staffed by, you know, one or two nurses who are catering to hundreds of kilometers of people who can't afford to travel to go to larger hospitals in the city, or the distance is just too far. And these staff are really working with the bare minimum of equipment and now less staff. So a lot of people that I've met over the last few weeks at hospitals have brought up this kind of question of what's happened to the aid that was once going into these hospitals, and when is it coming back? This is a repeated question that I keep getting asked, when is it coming back? And we have to remember that this is a country that's lived off a war economy for years and has always been an aid-dependent country. People relied on the aid, and they relied on the jobs that the aid brought. So many of the humanitarian challenges that we're seeing now have always been here, but they've worsened since the aid got cut. And I watched in late 2020, even before the Taliban took control of the country, and during the US and NATO troop drawdown, that donors had already started pulling their support from Afghanistan and from hospitals in Afghanistan. And these programs continued to close throughout 2021, and, you know, salaries were cut and jobs were lost. So there's this whole, like, issue with the humanitarian need and the need that people, like, this is a general need across the provinces. But I do want to note as well that the challenges are not one thing. Kabul is miles apart from rural Afghanistan, and it has always been. And in the sense of opportunity and access to healthcare and to education, and also in mentality. So, you know, on top of this, one province is not the same as the next, and one district's not the same as the next. So I think that some interesting things that I've noticed and that people have said to me are that in some provinces, you know, not a lot has changed. People go about their daily business as they always have. These were Taliban-held areas and were areas where politics always felt like really far away. They were not reached by the international community or even by their own government. And today, they're in need of humanitarian assistance, but they always have been. In other areas, there's been like some surprises, in a sense. In areas that were under government control, I've seen schools opening now for the first time, and with the support of local Taliban officials and the community. In fact, some of the Taliban's daughters are going to these schools, and the imams and mullahs in these areas all disagree with the government's decision on the ban of high school girls' education, which you're going to talk about later, but they say it's a political decision, not Islamic. So you have 15-year-old girls getting their first education in a first-grade class with five-year-olds. In these areas where there was no school before, because of the security situation, or because, as some residents will say, the money for the schools never reached them. Yeah, I mean, these are areas of Kabul and Kunar and Parwan, and where there was no school before, there is now 25 schools in one district. I mean, it kind of leads me to talk about security or safety a little bit, because that's a bit, people have varying feelings and views on this from province to province as well. In some provinces, people will say they feel safer, but I say that cautiously because in some areas there's more restrictions and lack of freedoms are greater. I've met girls who are sat at home bored with nothing to do and no motivation. I've met former soldiers who are stuck at home with no work or purpose, and people who are depressed because they have nothing to do. And this sense of what good is security if you can't do anything or you can't work or provide a better life for your family. You know, there's men and women who also fear for their lives and live with this stress. There's people who say their family members have gone missing and not returned. But then in other areas, people praise the fact that they can travel more freely, that they can cross areas that were once front lines and where there was fighting, and they can return to home provinces that they were displaced from years before because of the fighting. though I will add this is largely men, not women. I drove across 6 provinces a couple weeks ago, and I went through 15 checkpoints, which is a lot lower than it once was. And the other checkpoints are now lie abandoned, probably occupied only by a sheep. So there's a lot of changes to that front of travel. Yeah, I mean, I think that one feeling that does come up a lot that I'll probably close on is that I think overall the Taliban don't have people's trust. I met some military doctors in Kandahar who spent years treating both Afghan and American casualties of war. They're still working at the same base and they're like, yeah, I have a job, but my salary's been cut and I'm working with these guys I can't trust, essentially. They attacked our base years ago. They killed my friends and I still have to go to work with them every day. I had a debate with someone else who was like saying the international community should come back and where's the aid and why are they not helping Afghans? And I was saying, don't you think the Taliban government has the job to handle these problems now, these economic and humanitarian issues? This is their job now. And his answer was this kind of shrug off, they're not going to do anything. You know, like, so there's this, underneath all these other challenges, there's this lack of trust that the government is going to be able to handle their own country. But I mean, they're here now and they need to step up, because I think the general feeling is the period of, well, let's see if they can handle this, is nearing its end. People are fed up of it. And they have a difficult job, but if they're willing to attempt it, then they need to engage with people outside of their group and with differing views to them.
Right. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing those observations on the ground. I think that the big takeaway there is that the picture is a very complex one and a very broad one. As you rightly note, the situation could be different province by province and even on more local levels. So thanks for sharing that, Lindsay. Let's Pashtana, let's bring you in now. You know, of course, as many know, you direct an NGO an Afghan NGO that focuses on education and health. And those are areas that one would think have been heavily impacted by Taliban rule. So what's your take on the last year, its impact on you and the work that you've done in Afghanistan?
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. I'm just gonna shed the light on what difference does it make when you're an Afghan and when you are a foreigner. So there's an NGO. We are partnered up with them. We run a school with them. And the funny thing for me is that the two leaders of the NGO, they can travel freely to Afghanistan and they have the safety and they have been working with girls, actually, that we are educating. But at the same time, I am right now unable to go. And even if I go, I'm asked, told many times that I will be asked by the intelligence services. What was I doing in the US? Who sponsored me? If I'm CIA and stuff like that. So that's one side of it that comes with it, where you are working as a person in a humanitarian industry or as an NGO person, you will be asked questions. Now, on reflections, I don't know if you remember last year, this time I was in Kandahar. Kandahar fell before Kabul, and what I remember from it was a complete shock. I couldn't believe it, that this could happen to us. But one thing that I have learned from history is when Kandahar falls, the whole Afghanistan, or Kabul falls, which is the capital of Afghanistan. Going on in circles about this whole Taliban will open up schools, Taliban will support girls' education, has been a hectic journey for all of us. Not only me as a person, as a woman, and someone who works with schools, it has been a hectic for the parents who have been trying to send their daughters to school and have given up. It's hectic for the school teachers, public school teachers who I work with, have given up on them and have left the country. And the same goes for every other person. So right now, when we look at Afghanistan, what I see is that the Taliban are actually alienating their own Afghans. Like, forget the humanitarian industry, forget the foreigners, forget everything. They're literally alienating their own girls, their own women. And I'm not sure what they are trying to do, who they're trying to please in order to do all this, because it does affect them politically. It does affect them socially. It affects them on international level, but they continue to do so. And one thing that I I would also want to reflect on is the fact that girls' education in Afghanistan has always been a sensitive topic. But we have to understand the reason that is a sensitive topic, because Taliban in the past 2 decades have blown up so many schools that no parents would send their daughters to school. And the same goes for the corrupt government too, who have used schools to funnel money, who have used teachers and ghost teachers to take their fair share of money. So for me, when I reflect on all these, I think Afghans have never had a proper government, proper representatives, and the Taliban are doing the same exact thing what the last government did. The government was alienating the rural community. The Taliban are alienating the women and girls of Afghanistan right now. Yeah.
So thank you for that really important intervention. Let me sort of play the role of devil's advocate and feel free to push back again. As I understand it, in Afghanistan now, younger girls are in school, or many younger girls are in school. They're not prevented from going to university either. It's the issue of the, you know, older girls' secondary school education. That's where the controversy lies. And some have argued that there may be more girls in school now than there were before the Taliban took over. So how would you react to that? How would you respond to that? And does this suggest, I don't want to use the word improvement, I don't want to try to give the Taliban credit that it may not deserve, but might that suggest an improvement from when the Taliban was last in power in the late 90s? So I'm curious how you would respond to that type of commentary.
So I do appreciate you playing that role. On one side, yes, they are leaving the girls to go to school from class 1 to class 6. But on the other side, you also, when others look at it, there's always this one way, and please excuse me when I say it, others, because they see that, okay, the Taliban are letting girls from grade 1 to grade 6 to school, and from universities to go to university. So that's probably an improvement. Here's what happens when they're going from grade 1 to grade 6. The teachers are harassed on daily basis when they're going to schools, because the foot soldiers, they cannot accept the fact that the school and letting women go to school or girls go to school, it's still a thing, or it's allowed. I remember myself in September 2021, the Taliban harassed women, female teachers in Kandahar from Malali School. They took all their money. They took all their gold. They told them that if you come again to the school, we will not let you enter. And that continued to happen for multiple days for different schools. And they were so scared to go to schools and teach. That's one side of it that nobody reflects on. The second side is, I think you have already seen, is when the girls are going to university. They have been told what scarves to put on. They have been told who to come with. They have also been told that if they are leaving the country for another, which is a big chunk of our students that have been going to India, that have been going to Central Asia countries, they cannot leave without mahram. So all those factors as an educator are discouraging girls from being in school, because at the end of the day, nobody can afford the fact that if I have to go, my younger brother, who's 18 or 17 years old, has to go with me, and I have to afford his flight ticket and his education. And he, on daily basis, if he's going to school, it doesn't matter. He has to drop me, he has to pick me, and that all has to happen. Other than that, the same goes for the primary level girls who have to be escorted by their parents. And at the same time, one thing that we have to understand, the schools that were open back in the day, the 18 schools, let's pick the example of Kandahar, which is 17 schools, right? And we have 17 districts. So all those 17 schools in the city might have been open, and they are open to girls from grade 1 to grade 6. The women, girls in Maruf, girls in Argasan, girls in Dan, girls in Spinbuldak, they still don't have access to school. So there's no improvement for me. As a local, when I look at it, there's no improvement. They're just trying to make sure that they meet midway with the international community and show them that, yes, see, we open these schools, we can open other schools too, only if you give us more aid, more legitimacy, more private jets for us to travel to Norway and the New York, you know. So I'm going to be very sarcastic about it, but it's a reality for us. I don't see any improvement on my end that I would say, okay, yeah, that might have been a big deal.
Thank you for that. No, that makes perfect sense. And I think underscores the truism that numbers are not necessarily the best metric to use here in engaging the status of women's education under the Taliban in terms of how many girls may be in school. But thank you for that, Pashtun. I wanted to bring in Ashley now. Ashley, you, of course, are an expert on armed groups, including the Taliban. And, you know, we've been hearing over the last 20 minutes about some of these policies that the Taliban have come out with over the last year and the impacts they've had, especially on women. So what would you say are some of the factors that have driven the Taliban's policies over the last year? Why do you think that they've chosen to act how they have? I know it's a very broad question, but, you know, just generally speaking, what comes to mind when you think about the last year in Afghanistan and how what factors might have motivated the Taliban in their decisions, their policies, their actions? What stands out for you?
Well, I mean, I would qualify your very generous introduction and say that I don't think anyone's an expert on the Taliban these days, including the Taliban themselves. In terms of the last year, I think it has, as you said in the introduction, really confounded people's analysis and expectations of what would happen, what could possibly happen, what could be foreseeable. And I think we have to kind of try to understand how the Taliban is working as a government, but for all the reasons Pashtana and Lindsay talked about, this very mixed picture, that's very hard to do. I have a couple of very tentative observations to offer in reaction to your question. And the first is to kind of frame the Taliban as a vaguely functional mess. I mean, the government functions in some respects, but it doesn't function in some very key ones, in part because they can't seem to make decisions about anything really important to the survival of Afghanistan. Of course, they've made a number of controversial and devastating decisions for a lot of Afghans. A lot of those have focused on women, or a lot of the ones we read about in the international media, that women can't travel without a mahram, that that women should be fully veiled in public, or, you know, stay at home if at all possible. And of course, girls' education. And when the girls' education decision happened, I think it's attracted a lot of attention because it was such, again, another kind of like unprecedented thing. You know, up until the night before, the Ministry of Education was assuring donors. There were people in Doha assuring diplomats, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. And then it wasn't fine. And I think what we've learned from that decision, and I wrote about this at the time for Afghanistan Analyst Network, really trying to talk to sources in Kandahar, throughout the country, and in the, you know, people who were somehow on the fringes of this. And in part, it is because the Taliban doesn't have a mechanism to make decisions. You know, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of people within the Taliban government, or what we might call technocrats or civil servants, really, left in places like the Ministry of Education, who push forward to sort of the end of their leash on things like girls' education or on other policies without trying to confront others within the Taliban, basically seeing, you know, getting caught trying to see how far they can push things. And then all of a sudden, as in the case of girls' education, the emir and a very conservative circle around them, around the emir, brings the gavel down and says, no, this isn't acceptable. And you've seen a lot of backpedaling, even a couple of days ago when you had a Taliban official talking about cultural reasons why girls couldn't go to school. And there's a lot of discomfort within the movement around this. And Pashtana and Lindsay also touched on this, their own inability to bring the movement along, to present a real vision for the future of Afghanistan is creating tensions. Local commanders have to deal with angry religious officials, parents, girls, students. They actually have to manage the fallout from some of these decisions. And their job is simply to keep things going with, in some cases, not a lot of money and not a lot of capacity to do so. And it doesn't help when the Taliban leadership, very isolated from Afghan realities and aspirations, even in really conservative communities, they do generally want their children to go to school. Yeah, it doesn't help when there's that real disconnect. And as I said, you know, it's important to look at, you know, as much as we look at the decisions that they have made, we have to look at the decisions that they haven't made. 1 year on, this is still an interim government with interim ministers. There's no constitution. Again, there's no real vision of what the future of Afghanistan is. There's a lot of blaming America and blaming the West, which rightly so in a lot of instances. I mean, the way that the Taliban chose to take power triggered an economic and humanitarian collapse, which was beyond what people would imagine could be catastrophic, just the bottom dropping out of everything. Lindsay talked a lot about this, 90% of Afghans not having enough to eat. But still, the Taliban haven't done themselves any favors. I think the assassination of Zawahiri in the middle of Kabul and Sherpur illustrates that it is a nuts situation, to be perfectly honest. And that's not terribly, articulate analysis. But I think we're looking at a movement that is fractured. And I'll make sort of two more points. Pashtana and Lindsay have really know the nitty gritty on the ground realities of what differs from district and province and person to person. Some people feel safer. Meanwhile, there have been a number of disappearances, torture, all these things that have been mentioned in UN and Human Rights Watch reporting. And that fractured experience, I think, points to two things. It's an outcome of this sort of marginally functional mess that is the Taliban government. They can do some things. They can manage some things at the local level or at the central level, but they can't manage others. And they can't do it consistently across the country with any measure of consistency. And I think that's something that a lot of journalists in their 1 year on coverage have struggled to convey. You know, you have these polar opposites of experiences within Afghanistan right now. And I think it's hard to kind of hold on to that both things can be true, that things have gotten better in some people's perception and unbelievably worse in others. The final point I'll make is that I think the bottom line is that the war isn't over. We've just entered a new phase because there's this general sense of how long can the Taliban actually last? How long can they continue within the economic and security conditions? How can they continue to do this? And while there might have been some relief by some segments of the population immediately after the Taliban takeover, relief from the 80% or whatever it is drop in civilian casualties and things like that, there's now a lot of fear, whether it's fear of being targeted because you like worked for the international community or the Afghan forces, or fear that things are just going to get worse, that Afghanistan will enter a new phase of civil war because the Taliban has excluded so much of the population from its rules, its governance, from participating in life. And they have very little that they're proposing to offer in terms of vision for the country. And I think for Afghans, the risks are a lot more unpredictable, and there's a sense of foreboding. And for me, as someone who's watched and tried to understand the Taliban, I really concur with that. But I'll stop there.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, Ashley. And you've actually brought up several points that I'd wanted to pose to the broader group, especially that issue of that question of survivability, the political future of the Taliban. I think that's a really important point. I hope to get to that in a bit. But first, I wanted to bring in Andreas, and I wanted to sort of broaden the scope a bit. We, of course, have been discussing how things have played out in Taliban-led Afghanistan over the last year, but I think the geopolitical context is critical. So I was wondering if you could say a few words in a broad sense about some of the reactions in the region and implications for the region. I know that, you know, through your work with RFURL, you keep a close eye on Iran and Pakistan, I believe. So if you wanted to touch on those countries, if you'd like, and any others in the region. And in particular, would you say that the region has accepted the reality of Taliban rule, even if it has not been willing to recognize it? We know that no country in the world has recognized the Taliban regime, and obviously that includes some regional players, including a few like Pakistan and China that some observers had thought would indeed recognize the regime. So would welcome any thoughts you'd like to share about some of the broader geopolitical implications and ramifications coming from 1 year of Taliban rule.
Yes, thank you, Michael. I just want to start off by saying, you know, we talk about the world and Afghanistan, and I just want to give special kudos to Pashtana. I'm responsible for Radio Azadi, the Azadi Radio, which is our broadcasting and our output in Dari and Pashto. And thanks to Pashtana Learn Afghan, we have started broadcasting a comprehensive curriculum for girls who are unable to attend school. And so it's thanks to the world we live in that it's possible to do that and get the information via the internet. So thanks for that. And I say that because at the extreme opposite end, I think the first thing I want to just sort of the word I want to use in answer to your question about the region and the world and Afghanistan is the unbelievable levels of cynicism I mean, it is staggering. You know, the brazen, open appearance, you know, beardless of the head of the Pakistani ISI in Kabul less than 3 weeks after it fell to the Taliban, and just showing up at the Serena Hotel as if, you know, kind of some would say expressing a sense of ownership and so on. Just the fact that he could do that and be photographed, and, you know, the head of the ISI is in Kabul. In more cynicism, China's oppression of its Uyghur minorities, Muslim Uyghur minority, and the Taliban's complete silence on the topic because they want to curry favor with Beijing. The Taliban urging the parties to the conflict in Ukraine, well, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and urging them to seek a peaceful solution and so on. I mean, it's just staggering, as I said, the level of cynicism involved in all of this. And, well, yeah, I mean, in some senses, the world has come to accept the new regime in Afghanistan simply because, like Afghanistan itself, there's a certain sense of exhaustion, there's a certain sense of sitting back and waiting to see what's going to happen next. And the different approaches, of course, vary. One of the key issues is, as has been mentioned, the question of recognition to date, although there's been some exchange of embassies and representation, there is still no country that's recognized the new regime. And that, of course, as mentioned, affects the issue of aid and money and so on. And like the very creation of Afghanistan itself, in the sense, the buffer zone that it came to occupy between the Russian Empire and the British Empire, Afghanistan is still, to a great extent, at the mercy of other parties who want to exert influence in it, not necessarily because they want Afghanistan, but because they don't want anyone else to have it. So we have the Soviet Union invading some decades ago, and now we still have all the different countries around not really knowing what to do. So as you said, it's not clear what's going to happen with the recognition. It's still hasn't taken place. One would have expected it from Pakistan. It still hasn't happened. And I think there's a certain fear in Pakistan of blowback. So the Taliban went and took power. As I said, there's it's likely that there's some ISI influence and all that. And now there's quite a bit of concern in Pakistan about the TTP, their own militants, and what they're going to do next. Iran certainly is taking a watchful eye. How are the Taliban going to treat their Hazara and Shia minority? And there have been border clashes across the various borders. There have been border clashes very recently between Iranian and Afghan border guards. Same has taken place on northern borders with Central Asian countries. And there are a lot of really practical issues. I mean, Afghanistan owed probably $100 million in owing for electricity supply from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and now the Taliban have paid the $70 million or so dollars of that they owed Uzbekistan. They still haven't made good on what's owed to Tajikistan and Tajikistan electricity company. Those countries are taking different views. Perhaps Uzbekistan sees, you know, possible trade, and obviously it's happening by supplying electricity. Tajikistan is taking a more watchful eye. So all around the region, they're kind of waiting and watching. And of course, countries that were once very involved, such as the U.S., I mean, if you think back on the Soviet invasion and the U.S. supplying the Mujahideen, it's made quite clear that it's not going to be supporting any armed opposition to the Taliban. So it's, I guess to sum it up, it is kind of a wait and see. And as Ashley said, I mean, it's not clear that the war is necessarily over. I mean, there is armed resistance, and we don't know what's going to happen next, but we're all basically watching to see what does happen.
Well, thank you, Andreas. And yeah, I think you hit on a very important point that, you know, one could argue that there's not too much that's surprising about what played out inside Afghanistan the last year. Unfortunately, I think so many of us expected this terrible, horrific economic humanitarian crisis, and you know, many of us, other than those that are rather naive, would have expected the Taliban to implement some of these just terrible policies. We expected them to struggle, but I think what is a bit surprising is the geopolitical context, in the sense that, indeed, as you note, Andreas, the region has been very cautious, and there were a number of observers that thought once the U.S. left Afghanistan with the Taliban in power, that America's rivals, China, Russia, Iran would rush in and try to replace the U.S. presence in some way. But clearly that hasn't happened because these countries are being very cautious for many reasons. One, of course, being security concerns. In the case of Iran, concerns about inclusivity. But I think that's a really important point to make. So we have in the 10 minutes we have left, I just wanted us to turn to the future. We've talked about the last year. I'd like us to look ahead at the next year. Pose a, I guess, a two-part question, and I open it up to whoever would like to reply. I guess the first part of it is really, gets to the issue of surprise. I talked about what had surprised me, what had not surprised me. Are you surprised about where the Taliban is at now? I mean, the Taliban, as I said before, it does not appear to have any type of viable opposition at this point. I mean, yes, there's Islamic State Khorasan, but that's a terrorist group that could certainly hit out at the Taliban, but is not in a position to cause it to lose power. And then you do have the NRF, the National Resistance Front, of course, which is based in Panjshir, though some of its leaders appear to be over the border in Tajikistan, but it's been limited in terms of its capacity. So I guess the first question is, are you surprised that the Taliban is still in full control in the same place that it was August 15, 2021? That's the first question, part of the question. The second part of the question is, do you expect that it could it continue to enjoy that type of control over the next year? Or do you think that it could start to face more challenges to its rule? I know it's speculating, but I think it's useful to think ahead. So anyone like to respond to that? Please just feel free to unmute and respond.
I'll take a stab.
I know it's a tough question, but one we're all thinking about.
Right. I mean, anyone who's making predictions about what might happen next in Afghanistan, I think, is on thin ice, because there are many, many possible outcomes. But in a way, dare I say it, that might be hopeful. I think there's still a lot that the international community can do to avert the worst suffering on the ground. I don't have a lot of optimism that the Biden administration will change course on some of the harmful kind of sanctions related measures, but there are still things that can be done. There's still ways to, without recognizing the Taliban, to engage with them with the specific aim of trying to alleviate suffering in Afghanistan, to try and avert the worst possible outcome, because I do think it can always get worse. And if I was working for the U.S. government or a Western government or a regional government, I would have that in mind. My objective, foreign policy-wise, with Afghanistan would be to imagine the nightmare scenario and do everything I can to prevent that from happening. And I think, I mean, that's where we are now. You know, in the space of a couple of years, we've gone from a narrative around Afghanistan of trying to turn the tide against the Taliban, to hold on to these incredible gains that have been made over the past 20 years, to now really just trying to prevent things from getting worse. My fear is like that a lot of diplomats and others will have a failure of imagination yet again on that front, and not be considering just how badly things can get, be underestimating their own political capacity to influence the situation and to take action. And that this simply isn't a priority for many of them anymore in the face of Ukraine, inflation, and everything else going on.
Thank you for that, Ashley. Well, I think we should probably start wrapping up, and I'll do what in honor of Mohammed Tahir, what he used to do at the end of each show, is invite each of our guests to offer a very quick final thought, particularly in terms of what do you think is going to be the most important thing to be watching in the coming months. But more broadly, if anyone just wants to offer a quick final thought as we wrap up here, Lindsay or Pashtana or Andreas, if anyone wants to weigh in, please just please do so now.
I think a key question is going to be how the Taliban are going to square this inherent conflict between trying to show the rest of the world that they're not the Taliban of yore, and to try to put on the face that they very expertly began to put on with their Western and international facing Twitter accounts, etc., with the very much, shall we say, frankly, troglodytic point of view, a lot of their foot soldiers who, you know, blindly supported them and helped bring the Taliban back to power, who want a much, much, much more conservative Afghanistan than the Taliban national leadership is projecting. So I think a key thing to watch is going to be the tension between that outward-facing international and national front and the local You know, are the people on the local front really going to be happy with what they see the leadership doing on a national level just for the purpose of getting aid and money?
Thank you. Pashtuna, please go ahead.
I think I would just like to add one last point is in Pashto, we say that people, when they tend to do something for someone else, an evil thing, they tend to forget that they are the ones who are digging up that hole for themselves, and they are the ones who will be in it first. So I think people who supported Taliban for the longest and countries who supported Taliban for the longest didn't think that the fight that they're making for Afghanistan, their countries will be burned in it too. And we can already see that there is already this growing power of Taliban in those regions, and they are taking over, they're murdering their own security forces. And I think that's one thing that the regional powers have to consider. And that could go for international community too, who legitimized Taliban. They need to reevaluate that. Was that a smart move? And what should be done to contain that? So I think that's the most important thing that we need to highlight. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Pashtuna. Yes.
Go ahead. I think, I just want to note, like, that I think that people are, you know, really healing right now, and they're still healing from the wars that came before, and they're healing from drone strikes and airstrikes and night raids that really kind of ravaged rural communities in particular, and for which there's been no accountability. And they're healing from those they lost in fighting, whether it's civilian or soldier. And what kind of repeatedly comes up is that these people don't feel that this kind of relatively quiet period that we have right now is going to last. There's this kind of like tense anticipation in a way of what comes next, which Ashley talked a little bit about as well. So there's that underlying and kind of bubbling up that it's not going to last, you know?
Absolutely. No, I think that's a really, really critical point. Well, I think we need to start to wrap up now. This has been a really powerful, very useful conversation at what is a very difficult moment for Afghanistan and many Afghans marking this this anniversary. And it'll be a few difficult weeks, I think, for many, for sure. But I really appreciated our panelists for being candid and also careful to provide a very nuanced look at how things have gone in Afghanistan over the last year since the Taliban takeover. But we do need to wrap up. Again, I wanted to thank our four panelists. They were Lindsay Billing, who's an investigative journalist and photographer, Pashtuna Durrani, who is the executive director of LEARN, NGO in Afghanistan dedicated to education and health, Ashley Jackson, co-director of the Center for the Study of Armed Groups at the Overseas Development Institute, and Andres Ilves, director for the Near East region with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. A reminder that we will be back with another special edition in a few weeks, marking the anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. But for now, thank you all for tuning in. I'm Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South Asia with the Wilson Center. Thanking you all for tuning in. Take care, everyone. Stay safe, and see you the next time.